Quick impression for you.
Call, bang, fuck, I'm dead!
To walk into our town and promote hate, violence, suicide, death, drug use, and Columbine-like behavior, I can say...
Linking violence in movies to higher levels of aggression and violent behavior. Recognizing that many children love violent movies.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to make scale.
Take a look around!
Dodge this.
Welcome back to Take a Look Around, a podcast that finds itself at the intersection of nu metal and Hollywood. Rising from the grave as an avenging angel, my name is Shawnee Campion, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Alistair B-Man Bates. How are you, Batesy?
I'm good, man. I'm just flapping away. It's good to be here in the Take a Look Around nest. You know, you can't review the nu metal movies without cracking a few eggs, some crow eggs.
Oh, yeah, crows. Nice. Brought it all back home in a neat little package. I love it.
That's right. That's right.
Now, Al, we find ourselves at the penultimate episode. This will be the final film covered on Take a Look Around. We do have a special treat for the listeners in a couple of weeks to round everything up. But we figured that for the final film, we wanted to go back to where it all began, really. And I feel no film better sums up the nu metal ethos before it really began, the nu metal aesthetic than this film, The Crow.
The Crow. That's right. This week, we are doing Alex Proyas, Australia's very own, once again, as executive producer and friend of the show, Phoebe Paradise, pointed out, some of the greatest nu metal movies involve Australians, and I think after, you know, much consideration, we can probably consider nu metal cinema to be a truly Australian product if this is one of the first instances of it.
I 100% agree with you. Before we get stuck into it, though, for one last time, Al, because I want to know, are there any upcoming nu metal movies?
If only we could fly!
Now, for the year of our Lord, coming up to Al's favorite day of the year, January 26th, are there any nu metal movies upcoming on the horizon? The answer is no. There are no new nu metal movies. I really thought after 2 years of doing this podcast, we might get one.
No, I think maybe there are. I think we've got Morbius. What's the new Spider-Verse?
I refuse to believe that Morbius is ever going to come out. We are on our fourth knockback. It's been coming out since we started this podcast. Yeah.
It must be really good if they're holding it back this long, you know?
We might see Michael Morbius starring Jared Leto, but who knows? It's not for us to find out. All right, let's get stuck into The Crow, baby. Play trailer.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
That gasoline I smell?
Victims, aren't we all?
Thank you.
Okay. So The Crow, I mean, it's impossible to separate this film from what occurred, isn't it, Al? Like,
absolutely. And that was like one of the big things I kind of thought about whilst watching it.
Tragedy, it seems, runs in the family. Bruce Lee was a movie star who died young and became a legend. Now his son Brandon is gone as well, fatally wounded while starring in a movie.
5 hours of surgery at this hospital could not save the life of 28-year-old Brandon Lee. He was fatally injured on the set of his latest movie, The Crow. Sarah Seidman, a stand-in, was there when it happened.
When Brandon didn't get up, everyone was stunned because in the scene he was supposed to fall down and be mortally wounded. So, I mean, the actors went on with the scene. They didn't know until the director said cut. Nobody knew.
Initial reports indicated that Lee was shot in the stomach by a prop gun.
That's, I guess, what made it a classic to maybe the generation before us was they got to live the whole, oh my God, Brandon Lee died and this movie's just come out. And this is why it's a cult classic. Whilst we're like, what, nearly 30 years divorced from that? You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird thing to watch now without that in context.
Because, like, I mean, for the film to come out, Brandon, like, the way that this film was made out to me growing up was that it was a star taken too soon.
But yeah.
30 years divorced, he really didn't have anything going for him aside from being Bruce Lee's son. He was in Showdown in Little Tokyo, like a direct-to-DVD film with Dolph Lundgren, but people made it out as if it was like the second death of Kurt Cobain, like the cinematic death of Kurt Cobain.
I think, you know, there's probably the baggage of his dad also dying very young and tragically. So his dad, of course, being famous martial artist and friend of Chuck Norris, fucking Bruce Lee, right? Chuck Norris, huh? I think that's like something that we need to be bringing back for the noughties revivals, just some Chuck Norris jokes? Earnest Chuck Norris jokes, yeah.
All right, you start with the Chuck Norris jokes. I'll be doing the Harlem Shake and planking.
Oh, damn, you're getting in ahead.
There's going to be a big 2009 revival right around the corner.
Man, I can't wait.
Anyone that doesn't know what we're talking about, star of the film Brandon Lee, son of Bruce Lee, at age 29?
Too young, baby.
Was killed when a prop gun misfired during the final days of shooting. The filmmakers plunged on and released the film for it to become a cult classic that will be forever kind of associated with the death of its star due to its subject matter. Like, this whole film is about coming back from the dead and avenging what occurred to you in your life.
And that is dying on October 30th, Devil's Night.
So yeah, the film opens up in Detroit on Devil's Night, October 30th, the night before Halloween, where apparently, as is tradition in Detroit, street gangs and criminals just set bulk fires. Like, yeah. This is an actual thing where just mass arson is committed across a major metropolitan city and has been for like the last 30 years. I was blown away to find out this was real.
Yeah, I think it's been happening since like the fucking 50s. And like, I just didn't realize until after watching the movie and rereading the plot. I was just like, this is some kind of unnamed post-apocalyptic hellhole that sucks. Like, what kind of fictitious, horrible hellhole could this be? And then finding out it was Detroit, I was like, okay.
You know, I've been to Detroit. It's not too bad, to be honest. It was pretty fun.
Isn't that the whole deal now, though? It's like a big, cool college town because nobody wants to fucking live there.
Yeah, I think like rent is like next to nothing. Detroit suburbs, though, like the suburbs of Michigan where all the white flight happened during the like 60s to 80s onwards, that was the largest concentration of Trump voters in all of America.
Fantastic.
Back to Devil's Night. As soon as I realized what it was, I was like, oh, that explains the D12 album title.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that either. I just had completely forgotten about D12. and then to be reminded by this fantastic movie. It's a true treat.
Watching this and reading about it, like, I couldn't help but think about somewhere down the line in the last 40 years or so, someone working in the Detroit Fire Department is like, do you reckon I could put in for annual leave on October 30th? Yeah. I reckon I could get away. I've been with the company a couple of years now. I reckon it'll be pretty chill this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I might just chuck a sick day that day. It'll be fine.
No one will notice.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's got the right idea.
And you know what everybody noticed, Al? The miniature work on this film.
That's right. Like, I recently just rewatched Star Wars A New Hope, but someone did this 4K remaster of an original print, and like, after watching that, I was like, oh my god, I forgot how much I love fucking miniatures. And then the next movie to literally be The Fucking Crow and an opening on cool miniatures, I was like, fucking take me to Mini Town, I want to be there all the time.
It does look fucking amazing. The opening shot of this film is like kind of a dolly shot across Detroit as it burns down, with this absolutely gorgeous miniature work.
Yeah.
Coinciding and finishing up in the apartment of one Eric Draven.
Which sounds awfully a lot like De Crow.
It's not the only time in this film. Like, there's his name is Eric Draven. There's like a scene later on in the film where he quotes The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. It's like, are you sure you guys like are aware of what a crow is?
Yeah, totally. I know what they look like.
So the film opens with Ernie Hudson. You might know him from Ghostbusters.
And Oz, and that's it.
Yeah. I love seeing him in stuff. Like, he's always like a welcome face, I reckon.
Yeah.
Was he in the new Ghostbusters movie?
Well, I'm guessing nobody who listens to this show. Maybe Sam might be the only other person who gives a shit about Ghostbusters.
The two oldest people I know.
Yes, and Bill Murray. Like, literally, probably if I saw the new Ghostbusters, I might have said this on a previous episode, if I saw new Ghostbusters last year, it would have been the worst movie I saw last year. it's astoundingly bad.
So Ernie Hudson plays Bernard Albrecht, named after Bernard Sumner's pseudonym he used in Joy Division before changing it back to Sumner for New Order, which just blew me away. Like, that's just a weird choice.
Yeah, well, like, so the guy who wrote The Crow is like a huge goth, well, he's a huge goth nerd, but like, he was super into Joy Division, right? That's why all that weenie stuff is on the soundtrack.
Like, yeah, like The Cure and Joy Division were like his biggest influences on making it. And like, this really is like a touchstone for goth culture, this film.
Totally.
Like, The Crow was like huge with the like...
It was Black Panther for goths.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what it was. He is at the apartment of Eric Draven, who has been... Him and his fiance have been murdered by a gang of thugs. Ernie Hudson meets up with Sarah, a local girl, a local kind of street kid, who is friends with the couple, and tells them that unfortunately Eric has passed away, but his fiance Shelley might not make it and is going off to hospital. The film kind of cuts from there to exactly 1 year later, once again on Devil's Night, where Eric Draven, played by Brandon Lee, crawls out of his own grave, kind of disoriented and like freaked out, and like wanders back to his apartment to find that not only is he dead, but his whole life has been turned upside down.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm kind of shocked that he didn't figure out that he was dead after climbing out of his own grave that had a tombstone with his own name on it. But I mean,
we've never been in that situation. It's hard to know how you'd react.
It's true. I didn't
realize... Who are we to contradict Brandon Lee's lived experience or his death experience?
That's right. I mean, I didn't realize it was going to be so literal, too. Like, he's crawling out. I figured he'd be some kind of... apparition with, you know, some tangible apparition rather than literally his own corpse coming back from the grave.
Al, what does this opening and just this film in general remind you of?
Spawn.
Spawn. This film was ripped off wholesale for Spawn. The look of the film, the soundtrack, the like entire storyline is just ripped off wholesale for Spawn, which only came out a few years later. Spawn, of course, we covered early on in this podcast because it's a really early example of a nu metal film. But maybe we should have been covering The Crow from the beginning because this really is where it all starts, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, that's where it all ends too if you play by the rules of the new movies that are coming out of legacy franchises. Just, you know, of course, shout out to Scream 5, not
Five Scream.
Five Scream, yeah. But that starts where it all ends, or ends where it all starts, baby. Depends
time
on
is
how
a flat circle.
Right. I love that straight after the crow climbing out of his grave, we cut to this 5-minute scene with Ernie Hudson and the little girl talking about onions on their hot dogs. She's just like, I don't want onions on my hot dogs. And he's like, I just need some onions on my hot dog. Give me some onions. It's fucking awesome. I think it's like one of the only times they really try to make Ernie Hudson's character look like a regular Joe. He's walking around smoking a cigarette, or he's eating onion hot dogs, or there's that scene where he's in his apartment in his underwear whilst wearing a policeman's hat.
The best bit of the whole thing, especially since like it's revealed pretty early on that he has been kicked down to beat cop from detective, which like every other police officer just keeps reminding him of. And like I feel like cops like protect their own, and for the, like cops to be mean to each other, it's just kind of like he must have done something really bad.
Yeah. Or something really good. I mean, it's the police. It's in Detroit.
It's opposite day, baby.
Yeah, exactly. Up is down and down is up.
So in a series of flashbacks, it's revealed to Eric Draven that he was killed by the gang led by T-Bird, played by James Patrick Kelly of the Warriors and Twin Peaks fame. Always a pleasure to see him. He's the Warriors come out and play.
Damn.
The gang itself is introduced after this flashback in probably my favorite scene of the film. I think I texted you about it as soon as it came on. I'm such a huge sucker for films that in the opening scene to introduce a villain or like a real shithead character, they go out of their way to like show them doing something really weird to like make you like be weirded out by them. And in this film, the gang is shotting tequila, and for the chaser of their shots of tequila, they're just eating bullets.
Pretty awesome.
So like, good.
Would they would die from lead poisoning, right? Did they still make bullets out of lead? Surely they'd have to, right?
I remember in like grade 8 like or grade 9 like having a bet with someone that I could eat an iPod Nano and like I'd be fine. And I'm so unbelievably glad that they didn't let me eat their iPod Nano.
Oh yeah, man. I've somehow managed to like accidentally watch this Australian Story episode that's all about children accidentally eating fucking lithium batteries. It's just like every time I'm like really tired and bummed out, the controller's at the other end of the room. So I've just watched this thing about children eating batteries twice now. I'm glad you didn't eat that iPod.
Yeah, I don't think we'd be doing this podcast today if I had completely eviscerated my esophageal and intestinal tract with lithium batteries.
Tell me the truth. If you did it, would you be like, okay, here's the rub. I ate an iPod. We need to get it out of me now. Or would you just present yourself to the hospital and be like, don't know what it could be, but we should have a look at it quickly.
Good day, sir. I believe I'm having some intestinal stress. Would you be so kind as to avoid x-raying me and take it out immediately?
Yeah, exactly.
I believe this would not contravene your Hippocratic oath. So the gang itself is led by T-Bird, by James Patrick Kelly, but the other members of the gang are worth pointing out. Tintin is played by...
That racist old bastard. That racist Flemish bastard.
You reckon Tintin's racist? Oh, actually, it's super racist, isn't it? Yeah. Never mind. I'm just remembering every Tintin, which is like imprinted on my psyche.
Yeah.
We've got in the gang Lawrence Mason from Tintin. I was like, where do I know this guy? He's so charismatic. He's so great in this. And he's fucking in my all-time favorite film. He's Lord Nikon from Hackers.
Damn. Okay.
Along for the ride as well, we've got Michael Massey as Fun Boy. Michael Massey was on the come up in his career, but would forever be associated and kind of derail his career after shooting this because he was the guy that accidentally shot Brandon Lee. Completely traumatized him and kind of ruined his career from there on out. He died in 2016 from...
A freak crow attack.
Yeah. I'm sure it was made all the worse by the fact that he was dealing with the fallout for having murdered a young superstar.
I mean, it probably didn't help.
No. I said that this gang is made up of absolute winners, and I was wrong, because that's it. The other guy is an absolute nobody. Skank! Is his name
Skank? That's right. Angel David is Skank.
Yeah. If my name was Angel David, I'd be like, just call my character Angel David.
Yeah. Angel David doesn't have time to learn lines.
So basically, from here on out, Eric Draven kind of like paints his face in weird Joker makeup. Yeah. Like, once again, time is a flat circle. This film influenced the look of Heath Ledger's Joker. But watching this in 2022, all I can think of is Heath Ledger's Joker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's funny too, because like Eric Draven's a rock star, but from all appearance, like all the photos you see of his band, there are no like goth dudes in it.
Yeah.
There's like one guy called Mo Devious, which
Yeah, I love that we keep cutting to the same like publicity stills of his band, which are called Hangman's Joke. The band itself like gets played on a record in the film, and I remember thinking, this is the worst music I have ever heard. Turns out that's Brandon Lee's actual band.
Yeah, well, maybe Michael Massey did us all a favor. Could have Jared Leto'd us with 30 Seconds of Mars or whatever they're called.
The band itself in the publicity stills was a local grunge band from North Carolina where the film was shot, by the name of Charlie's on Acid. And this did zilch for their career.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, damn.
I mean, this was 1993 and we were still in the era of every like major label just like buying up anything that remotely sounded like Nirvana or Pearl Jam or something like that. And despite an appearance in a major motion picture, Charlie's on Acid were not able to pick up any kind of label deal.
Charlie don't surf. Charlie don't get signed by a record label.
So Eric Draven, there's a great montage that looks like the start of the Ali G show where he's putting all of the like leather outfit that he finds. It's so funny, like, you know, that this is his outfit. Like, I mean, it would have made, like, this is like ground zero for the aesthetic of the nu metal movie. And so he's got the big black trench coat, the leather pants,
Sweet Doc Martens, dude.
Some Sweet Doc Martens. But to like, it's still just like, you're right. This is Black Panther for goths, isn't it? Like, this is the first time that look, that aesthetic, that style really was just given like a major look in.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I guess that's a big part of why it was popular. It was like a right place, right time kind of deal. You had acts like Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson kind of getting big around this time. You know, who else? Fucking Typo Negative. Like, this was, I feel like, just the taking this aesthetic to the mainstream.
Yeah, like, I mean, 93 would be 1 year before Woodstock 94, which was the Great Mud Pit concert with Nine Inch Nails. My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult are one of the bands that play in the nightclub scenes in this.
Yeah.
Like, industrial was, and like goth was making its way into alternative rock at this point.
Yeah, well, yeah, Nine Inch Nails would have won a Grammy the year before for Broken.
Yeah.
You know, Nine Inch Nails is also kind of the foundational text for a lot of new metal and stuff.
So from here on out, Eric Draven basically sets out to murder the members of T-Bird's gang, starting with Tintin. They have a knife fight where Tintin is cut to shreds.
Every organ stabbed alphabetically was it, the...
Was that the line?
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck, that just sounds like something straight out of a Spawn comic. Like,
it does, yeah. I thought of like Deadpool just like eating a mouthful of chimichanga and then saying...
So from there on out, Eric heads to the pawn shop of Gideon, played in absolutely fantastic fashion by John Polito. This man is a walking fucking cartoon, isn't he?
He's such a fucking grub. Yeah. He looks so gross.
What do you know John Polito from? What's your like go-to John Polito movie?
I honestly couldn't tell you, man.
He has 220 credits.
That's wild. That is a lot of credits. You know, so we've everyone's watching the new Righteous Gemstones. I didn't realize until I looked it up the other day that Eric Roberts has been in something like 800 different movies.
I know. Like, when he appeared on screen in the Righteous Gemstones, my girlfriend Erin was like, where do I know that guy from? And I'm like, the film clip to Mr. Brightside by The Killers.
Oh, yeah. Damn.
I think my favorite Eric Roberts performance is Runaway Train. Have you ever caught that?
I have not.
The best film canon films ever released. If you walk away from one film today, don't watch The Crow, watch Runaway Train. Eric Draven heads into Gideon's pawn shop. We get some absolutely fucking stellar dialogue here that feels straight out of a Max Payne video game. Like, that's the other thing that I was like super like reminded me of this. Like, the Max Payne games have just like ripped off The Crow wholesale with their like street level like gangster thing mixed in with these like operatic and kind of poetic flourishes.
Yeah, yeah. It has to stop raining sometime or whatever the fucking cheesy noir line is that the little girl recognizes. So Sarah, is that the name of the little kid?
Sarah, yeah.
Sarah recognizes, kind of puts two and two together and realizes that her mum is seeing one of the people who killed the Crow.
because, every time.
Yeah, I know, right? She realized because the Crow says...
Can't rain every time.
Can't rain every time.
Which is a line by Hangman's Joke. We forgot to mention that's the name of Brandon Lee's band in this. Fucking hell.
Hangman's Joke, man. They rock.
They rock the Chasma. Rocket Man.
Rocket Man. I know you will. Everyone kind of figures out that a ghost has come back to kill them for killing the guy. Everyone's very chilled out about this as well.
As none more chilled out than any of them. The leader of T-Bird's gang.
T-Bird.
a gang kingpin by the name of Top Dollar, played in absolutely fantastic fashion by character actor Michael Wincott. He's unbelievably good in this film as the big bad guy, isn't he?
He's fantastic.
He has the like the most gravelly voice in all of Hollywood history. If you're wondering who we're talking about, he's the like the leader of the gang in Alien Resurrection. Like, that's where I know him from. He's like, fuck, I watched Alien Resurrection the other day. It was pure torture.
Yeah, right. I haven't seen it in like 15 years.
I'm so glad that like we've managed to like rid ourselves of Joss Whedon.
Because okay. I forgot that he wrote that. Are you doing a Joss watch after he's mega cancelled himself?
No, again? I would rather chew broken glass than do a Joss watch. Did you read that article where he tried to...
No, you just sent me the best of,
I think. I've never seen someone with a more prominent own goal than that article.
Yeah, right. Maybe I will check it out then. I do love a good, you know, I think you mentioned it was like the Miles Teller one where it was just like a dude, nobody asked you this question, so you didn't have to give us an answer.
Yeah, like nobody asked Joss Whedon why he accidentally killed a six-year-old boy as a child. But yeah, he tells us anyway.
If only he could have alien resurrected that boy.
If only he could have alien resurrected his fucking career.
Yeah, man. What is ass?
So Top Dollar assembles his best henchman by the name of Grange, and always fucking welcome Tony Todd. I absolutely fucking adore Tony Todd, and he's so good as this. The scene
when you sent me a message before I'd watched it saying something about Tony Todd, and for like the first maybe 30 minutes I was like, oh no, I think Sean's gotten Ernie Winslow confused with Tony Todd. So I was very relieved to see Tony Todd in this movie.
You know, you just called Ernie Hudson Ernie Winslow after his ghost. Who's confusing things now, Alistair Ernie Bates? Anyway, to the crowd. So basically, Eric Draven is making his way, bumping off individual members of the gang, working his way up to Top Dollar. He bumps off T-Bird, played by James Patrick Kelly, in what is like, I had to log on to Letterboxd to see if anyone noticed this, just how fucking wonky the car chase scene is in this.
Oh, it sucks. I think that was miniatures as well, right?
It's miniatures. Yeah, like, yeah. It looks fucking ridiculous. It's probably they were fucking RC cars, weren't they?
They'd have to be. Or I like to imagine somebody's just laying under the table with the fishing hook. Yeah, no, it looks like shit.
So after murdering the members of the gang, he's got one more to go. The aforementioned Skank, who is currently hiding out at just kind of like a conference for bad guys.
Yeah.
Led by Top Dollar. He just like gets every like fucking bad guy in the city together and just puts them all in one room to be like, we've got a problem, and that problem's name is the Crow.
The Crow. We kill the Crow. yeah, it's literally every scene where it's like, we got 8-Ball from the Gangster Disciples, Tony Lizzarelli from the Italian Mafia, Jackie O'Reilly from the good old Irish book. Like, everyone's there.
The Crow turns up, chucks a couple of little wisecracks in there and proceeds to just murder everyone in the room, which is really an excuse, I think, for Brandon Lee to use his like skills as a martial artist, which he hasn't really been able to do throughout the whole
dead.
Film. Because
he's
yeah, super duper fucking dead.
That's like another weird choice about this movie where it's like he's a ghost, but he shoots people. What happens after the bad guy club? Bai Ling, that's right. FHM Magazine's Bai Ling deduces that the magic of the Crow is what's keeping Eric alive.
I was just like, I think I looked up from my phone and was like, what did I miss? What did I miss?
Yeah. So she wants to get like Crow powers, but the Crow claws out her eyes.
I call them Crowers.
Crowers. She gets her eyes pecked out, which is like, maybe my favorite part of the movie is getting crowed on.
Yeah, I think we should point out here as well that to kind of lure Eric Draven out of hiding, they kidnap Sarah, the little street girl from earlier in the film, to kind of lure him to this church where basically they ambush him with, if you were listening to the start of the episode, Michael Wincott has the single greatest line in the whole film. Here's an impression. Who am I? Caw, caw, bang. Fuck, I'm dead.
Yeah, dude. This is a great, there's some fantastic quotes from this film.
Oh, so good. So this all leads, Bai Ling is killed, Tony Todd is killed, Ernie Hudson is there to help save the day with the crow.
Except he just stand, like, you know, they're just like, okay, I'm the superhuman, so I'll go ahead, and you're the human, and you'll hide undercover. So the first thing he does is walk up a flight of stairs and stand in the corner and just gets fucking shot up. It's so funny.
So it all leads to a final sequence where there's a big sword fight between Top Dollar and the Crow. Top Dollar loses his samurai sword, and so he just picks up a fucking weather mane and starts fighting with it. It looks cool as hell. The Crow uses his crow powers to, when he touches Michael Wincott, to distill the 30 hours of pure agony that his fiance felt after she was murdered into Michael Wincott and just fucking blow up his brain.
Fucking Neuralinks his ass.
Yeah. Top Dollar falls off the church to his death. The film wraps up from here with Sarah accompanies Ernie Hudson back to the hospital, and Eric Draven heads back to the graveyard to kind of put himself back to sleep, having kind of avenged his fiance. And the film just kind of wraps up from here with a nice little ending that says, for Brandon and Eliza. Eliza, of course, being Brandon Lee's fiance at the time of his death, who encouraged Alex Proyas to finish the film.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Were you wondering what that was all about?
I figured the brand was Brandon Lee. I just figured Eliza was someone's fucking mum who carked it whilst on the movie or some shit. I don't give a fuck. Do I remember it right? Does the movie end and he's like playing guitar on the roof or something?
I think that's just earlier in the film. But yeah, there is a really just like a couple of gratuitous shots of him playing guitar on the sunrise, or like a sunset or a sunrise. And then he just like smashes the fuck out of a little PV practice amp, a little Roland Cube.
So cool. I just want to live in like a tall building with a balcony and just do that nonstop. So Sean, did anything notable happen during the production of this film?
I'm so glad you asked. Because not only did its star get fucking murked by someone on the set, but even before that happened, crew members were kind of attesting to there being a genuine curse on this film. On the first day of shooting, a carpenter came into contact with a live wire and received third-degree burns to most of his upper body. There were a few other notable like mishaps, including a sculptor for the film, for the miniatures, who was fired and returned to set by driving his car through the plaster workshop.
Righteous.
I don't know how, like, what's the word? How truthful this is, but I read that apparently like cocaine usage was just rampant on the set. Someone sneezed during a take and Brandon Lee broke character to say that just was someone's $50.
Sure. Or something like
that. By all accounts, the film was made for $35 million, but was moved to North Carolina for shooting so that they could take advantage of North Carolina's ready for work clauses, which basically mean that it had a fraction of the requirements for like unionized and like safety standardized like
diligence.
Like I had a watch over a couple of news reports from the era reporting on Brandon Lee's death, and like there's interviews with people working on the film, and I don't think anyone was over the age of like 23 or 24.
I mean that's what kind of happened recently, right? Wasn't the master armorer on Alec Baldwin's Rust only 23 and non-union?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that was the first thing that popped to mind for me. Like if it wasn't the fact that like someone was killed on the set, but the fact that the working conditions, the environment, they were all just like almost exactly the same as The Crow. So for anyone that's curious about what actually happened and hasn't done any research into it, the way that it actually happened was similar to what happened on the set of Rust, in that the master
Alec
armorer,
Baldwin shot someone
yeah,
to death.
Alec Baldwin fucking murked Brandon Lee. You heard it here first. You got the scoop, baby. The master armorer was sent home early on the day, so everything fell on the props assistant that didn't realize that...
it was a real gun?
No, it was that blanks had already been loaded in the gun prior to them loading blanks. So the so there was already a projectile in there. So when they fired the gun, a blank is supposed to explode as soon as it's fired.
Yeah.
There was a tip in there not attached to the blank that was fired with the projectile force of an actual bullet. It was only, Brandon Lee was only about 10 or 15 feet away. So it was, yeah, it was the effective like result of shooting someone at point blank range,
all because somebody blanked on it. Yeah, it's crazy. It's the bat and like the Twilight Zone, I think, of like the two kind of, I guess, Rust now as well. But I mean, there are so many movies we've talked about during this show as well that have just had insane kind of labor laws, like all the fucking Resident Evil movies.
Yeah. They, like the deaths and accidents on that are insane.
Sean, if I've learned one thing doing this show, it's that maybe the business side of the movie industry is a bit shady.
So production wise, like, let's not put a poll on this, because like there are some genuinely like interesting parts of production. This production like would lead to some like really interesting careers. The film itself was produced by Edward Pressman. He would be the major driving force behind making this film. And he had a major name in mind for the actual film itself, which was one Alex Proyas, who he'd seen the video clips he'd done for In Excess and Midnight Oil and Crowded House, and was like, hey, let's give this motherfucker a go. And
okay,
this film is like 100% Alex Proyas's vision, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so that's how... So I always kind of wondered how he got his start, because... like, yeah, okay, that makes a lot more sense that he's a music video director, because you know, I love Dark City, I think it rocks, but like all of his other movies kind of suck ass. Like, I don't know,
we covered iRobot once before on the pod, and I told it was, I think, a Patreon ep. I think I told a story on that. I had a tutor in uni that said after making iRobot and the fallout from that, he went to set at 20th Century Fox, like, sorry, to the studio where he had an office, and the doorman just refused to let him in. He was just made persona non grata from Hollywood, like, after, like, the fallout from that. And, like, I think that, you know, he's one of those guys, if you have a look at his social media presence now, he's just, he's like Stephen Norrington. He's absolutely just had it with the industry. He was a guy that had his time in the 90s and was like a visionary director at the time. It's kind of just sick of his vision being, what's the word? Compromised? Yeah.
Or just disregarded. Just, you know, I think maybe a lot of the studios hired music video directors at the time, just because they kind of thought they might be like journeymen who'd do what the studio wanted rather than burn them out.
Yeah. I take umbrage with you saying that his other films are terrible, because I have a real soft spot for Garage Days. His like Sydney rock and roll film.
Yeah. Literally all of that is like near where I lived. Like, I lived off one of the streets. Crazy. That movie, I remember seeing it as a teenager and being like, this isn't as fun as I thought it was gonna be.
That's just down the road for me. So yeah, Alex Proyas worked like tirelessly with Brandon Lee to kind of like develop this film into something that both of them were like satisfied with. Like a lot of the like...
How did that work out for Brandon Lee?
So a lot of the like look of the film is very much Alex Proyas. Like he's got a very idiosyncratic style, which would inform so much of nu metal cinema going forward. For instance, the sets from Dark City were used as the sets for The Matrix. Like, you couldn't have Blade without the Crow kind of forging the same path of this kind of this look and feel, like a combination of Tim Burton's Batman with Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop.
Totally.
That kind of that Alex Proyas was able to bring to this. His like style is like so all over this film, and it's so crucial to the development of nu metal cinema.
Once again, another Australian icon contributing to the canon.
Absolutely. After Brandon Lee's death, the film itself had 3 days left of shooting, where famously Brandon Lee's stunt double filled in for him with his face digitally superimposed over the top. It was interesting to find out, I'd always known that story since seeing this film as a teenager, but the stuntman is Chad Stahelski, who would go on to be Keanu Reeves' stuntman on The Matrix.
The Matrix, yeah.
And then would go on to make the John Wick films as the director. He also was most notable in the past couple of months appearing as Trinity's boyfriend, Chad, in The Matrix Resurrections.
Yeah, I mean, there's some crazy stuff about this film behind the scenes, like the whole... Apparently, Alex Proyas and Brandon Lee were like so at loggerheads over what the makeup should look like that the only compromise they could reach was that Brandon Lee would put on the makeup the night before shooting and go to sleep in the makeup to come to the set with the smushed up makeup.
Do you like Brandon Lee in this? Do you think
he sucks, dude?
Yeah, he's so bad.
Really bad.
Like, I think I touched on this at the start of the episode that, like, this is not the, like, star being cut down in his prime that something like River Phoenix was.
Yeah.
Like, other people that were in the running for this, the studio wanted Christian Slater or Johnny Depp. And I feel like, yeah, like... It would have been interesting to see a world where Johnny Depp was killed on the set of The Crow.
Yeah, right?
Instead of being murdered by Barnaby Joyce.
And then there's like one trivia bit I sent you was apparently Brandon Lee lost weight to play this role, which is like, imagine just losing heaps of, like spending your last few days trying to lose weight only to get fucking shot and murdered on a movie that you were arguing with the director over.
Yeah, his birthday happened on set, and apparently they made him a birthday cake and he refused to eat it so that he could keep his physique for the film. It's just like, imagine like not getting your final birthday cake.
He didn't get to have his cake and eat it too.
Oh, nice.
There are no crows in this movie. They're all ravens.
Oh, fucking hell. I mean, we talked about that at the start of the film. Did they not realize what they were making?
Oh, but I mean, like, literally.
Yeah, I know, but right. Eric Draven, the Edgar Allan Poe shit, the fact that there were no crows. They should have called this movie The Raven.
You do it like this.
So this film is like super notable as being like a real early example in the 90s of a film that would have the same kind of like soundtrack approach as the nu metal films of the 2000s would, just like combining some of the biggest like alternative acts together to put together the soundtrack. The score itself is by nu metal luminary Graham Revell. I think this was his earliest like big budget film. It was right after Dead Calm, which was Dead Calm with what's it called?
Sam Neill
and Nicole Kidman. The soundtrack to this film is like pretty notable as to having like a lot of stars of the time that were kind of like just before the nu metal era. but after the grunge era. So you've got things like Roland's Band, Rage Against the Machines, Nine Inch Nails, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, and Pantera doing a Poison Idea cover. Like, the soundtrack is awesome.
What's the Rage Against the Machine song? Is it like a cover as well?
It's something called Darkness. But Nine Inch Nails contribute a cover of Dead Souls by Joy Division.
I think you were going to bring up the soundtrack to this and Judgment Night, but I think there's also another film that has a pretty similar kind of soundtrack that kind of gets forgotten a lot, which is the original Dread. The Judge Dredd soundtrack. Oh,
absolutely, with the Cocteau Twins track.
Yeah.
Dredd would actually be produced by Edwin Pressman as well right after this. I think he was like mining some similar territory. But yeah, that soundtrack is like super notable.
White Zombie, The Cure.
Yeah. Al brought up Judgment Night, which is the first time it's been brought up on this show, but we've had a number of fans hit us up in the social media about when we'd cover this film, because it's kind of crucial in the development of nu metal and nu metal cinema. It's not really super notable as a film. What's his name? Emilio Estevez and Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jeremy Piven.
And Dennis Leary, yeah. Don't forget Dennis Leary.
Tracked down by Dennis Leary in like A Night from Hell, where they're stalked by this gang member. But it was most notable for its soundtrack itself, which was the first big kind of collaboration between alternative rock and rap.
You're just another victim, kid!
Judgment Night soundtrack features 15 gold and platinum artists, including House of Pain, Run DMC, Sonic Youth, Faith No More, and Pearl Jam. And MCA Universal Home Video is supporting Judgment Night with a trailer which appears on the front of every rental copy of Hard Target, The Real McCoy, and the 1994 first quarter preview reel, creating excitement and instant POP impact for this hot new release.
There's some super like notable parts in this that would kind of go on to influence a lot of nu metal. You've got Biohazard and Onyx, Slayer and Ice-T, Helmet and House of Pain, but you've also got some insanely weird collaborations like Sonic Youth and Cypress Hill, Mudhoney and Sir Mix-a-Lot, Dinosaur Jr. and Del the Funky Homo Sapien.
And Teenage Fan Club and De La Soul, the Falling song that samples Free Fallin' by Tom Petty.
Wow.
That song rules, man. It's such a, like, a real nice song.
Judgment Night was, I'm pretty sure, straight to video at the time, but its soundtrack was ludicrously popular and would pave the way for nu metal. It was like a huge deal at the time.
Yeah, man.
It peaked at 17 on the Billboard 200.
Oh, wow. That's pretty high. But yeah, I mean, this was just like the time of the crazy crossover soundtrack album. Like, this is really where the wheel kind of got spinning.
Yeah. Future sequels to The Crow, I kind of did a bit of like panning around on them, having a look at them. This immediate sequel, The Crow City of Angels, which starred Vincent Perez, who's Marius from Queen of the Damned.
This is all round circle, man.
That features Korn and Deftones from the year 2000s, and features a performance by the Deftones.
Oh, we should have done the second Crow then.
Yeah, it looks fucking garbage, man. Like, Iggy Pop is the bad guy.
Oh, hell yeah.
The funniest is that, like, this isn't even the worst Crow sequel. In 2005, The Crow Wicked Prayer would star, I shit you not, David Boreanaz as the bad guy with Dennis Hopper, Tara Reid, Tito Ortiz from the UFC, and The Crow himself would be played by, right in the peak of his addiction, Edward Furlong.
Ooh, dear. That sounds pretty cool.
I watched 15 minutes of it last night, and it is dreadful. It's fucking one of the worst films I've seen.
UFC actors mid-noughties movies recommendation. I watched Scott Adkins's Ninja the other night.
Oh, yeah?
Have you seen it? Fucking awesome,
I love
dude.
Scott Adkins movies. The Universal Soldiers, Avengement.
Have you seen Ninja?
No, is it good?
It owns, dude. It's about a ninja.
Oh, surprise.
Who fights like this cult of satanic sex pedophiles who run the world.
Dies wide shut.
Yeah, there we go.
Because he's a ninja.
I like it. Look, we've talked soundtrack, but now I think it's time we take a left turn and figure out this film's Durst song.
That's right, baby. For the penultimate episode, we're bringing back fan favorite segment, The 6 Degrees of Durst.
Six degrees of Durst.
Al, would you be so kind as to fire up the Durst bot one last time?
You got it. Hopefully it still works after all this time.
I kept dumping Diet Coke into it, thinking that it would make it work better. Turns out, it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's probably because I've also been dumping Diet Coke in it. So we're putting too much Diet Coke into a computer.
You need to work out how much Diet Coke to pour into a computer.
Oh, man. I'm just entering the numbers now. It's looking right. Oh, my God. Okay. This is an anomaly. This is a very rare thing, Sean, but Brandon Lee has a Durst number of not one, not two, but three.
Oh, Jacques.
Jacques, that's right. Sean, Brandon Lee is connected to Fred Durst through the film Rapid Fire, which he co-starred in with Raymond J. Barry.
Wait, Fred Durst was in Rapid Fire?
Wait, no, Brandon Lee...
Brandon Lee was in Rapid Fire.
Had Raymond J. Barry. Raymond J. Barry was in Mad City with John Travolta, who was in Be Cool with Fred Durst.
Ah, nice. One day I'm going to have
Once
to
again,
watch...
brings it back to Be Cool.
I'm going to have to watch Be Cool or Pauly Shore is Dead, like, just to like get an idea about what we're actually talking about when we've constantly referred to these two movies during this segment. That's so crazy that that happens, because I think that three is exactly what I'm going to give this film for the Bodies Hit the Floor score.
So, Sean, going first for the last time, what is your Bodies Hit the Floor score?
Well,
for this
I literally just blew it straight away. My Bodies Hit the Floor score is three. This film is like crucial to the development of new metal cinema. I think it's really nice that we like wrapped out the pod with this as the final film, because everything starts here. You've got the soundtrack album, the like dark street level setting mixed with kind of poetic flourishes and martial art.
Plus spooky ghosts. Don't forget spooky ghosts.
Everything begins with this film. And as like much of an influence as it is on nu metal cinema, I can't go higher than a three because this film is pretty wonky.
Oh, yeah, dude. Like, even with that considered, I don't really have like a fondness for this film. When you told me that we were going to do it, I was kind of annoyed, just because I don't hate this movie, but I'm really just not that fond of it.
What I'm interested in is like how this film appeals to the next generation, because the idea of this like wisecracking avenging angel with gothic flourishes, it's like so tied to this kind of this like aesthetic that rappers like XXXTentacion and Lil Peep just made their bread and butter, but it's so far removed from like just their worldview just through sheer age. Like, they would have been not even born when this film came out.
And they're also now dead. No longer. I think like they died 6 or 7 years ago now as well. They're not like Cox of the Walk anymore. It's one of those, like, you know, that hot new band, the Arctic Monkeys. This is where we're at with, like, rap music now. I saw some, like, rap, quote-unquote rap off of rap writing last year, and, you know, it eventually happens to all of us, but, like, I didn't recognize any name on the list.
Like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I a friend of mine sent to one of our group chats Earl Sweatshirt being interviewed as an elder statesman of rap about RSK nephew. And it's like, oh no, am I getting older?
Yeah, dude, he was talking about having a kid and shit, and I was like, whoa, trippy. But yeah, man, I don't have a lasting fondness for this film, but I really enjoyed it on this watch quite a bit. I think I realized this was the first time I'd actually kind of seen a decent copy of it. I think I'd only ever watched this film on DVD or VHS.
Yeah, I watched the 4K rip as well. It looks gorgeous, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. It looks awesome. Like, all the, we've talked about the miniatures, but like they project a lot of the fire onto things in this, and it looks so well done. It looks very cool. Yeah, I mean, it's like a solid 2 for me, man. Like, I don't give a shit about this film still. I'm glad at least that, you know, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I was going to hate it.
Yeah, no, I get that. Like, it's like, especially with, like, we see what is influenced by this film, and it's
totally,
it's like when you watch new Hollywood films from like the 70s, like today, you're like, oh, is that what the fuss was about?
yeah, totally. I don't want to watch Casablanca, Grandma. Yeah, man. What do you think is like the craziest thing that we've learned about this whole genre of film? I think, like, when we started off, I don't think we really understood how we defined this subject as well as we did. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think there was an outline of what new metal films were until maybe we kind of defined what it was.
It's funny you mention that, because when we started this, there was nothing. But in the lead up to The Matrix Resurrections, I've seen podcast episodes, I've seen articles, I've seen think pieces about nu metal cinema, like, because we really hit the 20-year anniversary of it, and people were starting to, like, take note of this, like, what this was. But I think the number one thing I learned from all of this was that it was really the work of, like, a handful of people. Like,
A shadowy cabal
putting this together. It wasn't this, like, kind of aesthetic that appeared out of nowhere. It was the handiwork and, like, solid hard work of a handful of maybe like 10 to 15 people that put all of this together and kind of made such an impact on popular culture.
Yeah, we got LL Cool J, Graham Revell,
Colin Farrell,
the Weinstein brothers,
Neil H. Trent, Moritz,
Joel Schumacher. I mean, no, I agree, man.
Anders Bakowiak, the guy that did Cradle to the Grave.
Jürgen Prochnow and DMX. Yeah, I think one big thing I learned from all of this is that if LL Cool J is going to be in your movie, the movie's usually going to be pretty fucking good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, no, I meant terrible. The movie's going to suck.
We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in for 69 episodes.
Nice.
Like, when we started, we weren't sure about, like, where it had come from, but you guys have been tuning in week in, week out. We see the numbers. We, like, appreciate you so, so very much. We have a very special treat for you guys planned as the final send-off for Take a Look Around. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. Yeah, like, you guys are the real stars. We love you.
Yeah, a special shout-out to, especially to Phoebe Sheehy and Sam McKenzie.
Been there every step of the way as our producers.
You crazy SOBs, we did it.
Al, for one last time before we reconvene in a few weeks for the lookies, I think we need to go out on a track. What track is that going to be?
Take a Look Around by Limp Bizkit.
You know it, baby. Thanks so much, everybody. We love you.